Hey everybody, my name is Jesse Lee. I'm the Online Programs Director here at the White House. We're doing a thing all day where we're having roundtables following up on the President's State of the Union address on various issues. We just finished with Austin Goolsbee on the economy. Right now we're here with Dennis McDonough, Deputy National Security Advisor, to talk about the foreign policy elements of that speech. We're lucky enough to have some great online news sources here with us. We've got Roger McShane with The Economist. We've got Ward Carroll with Military.com, and we've got Josh Rogan with ForeignPolicy.com. And I'm also keeping an eye on the discussion here on our Facebook application. So keep chatting, keep discussing, and I'll pluck a question here and there and make sure your voices get heard too. So Dennis, I don't know if you want to just give a quick overview of kind of the president's themes in the speech, and then we'll kick off some questions.
Well, you know, I think what I'll do, Jesse, is just I'll welcome everybody. Welcome Roger, Ward, and Josh, and thank you all for coming, and thank the viewers for joining. And I think everybody saw the speech. I'd be happy to go through them, but rather than do that, why don't I just get right into questions? That way we get maximum time for people's concerns and ideas.
Okay, we'll just go around. So Roger, if you want to start it off.
Sure. Our readers had a lot of questions about Tunisia and Egypt and these kind of democracy movements in the Middle East and sort of unrest on the Arab street. And so we're wondering how the administration plans to support these movements and at the same time not alienate what are our allies in some of these authoritarian regimes in the Middle East. So how do you thread the needle?
Well, it's a good question, Roger, and I appreciate the opportunity to answer it. I'll say a couple things. You know, earlier this week, Jeff Feltman, our Assistant Secretary for Near Eastern Affairs, was in Tunis. He was the first international or foreign diplomat to be in Tunis since the events there. We're actually quite proud of the work that our embassy is doing on the ground. The fact that our embassy was calling attention to concerns that we have and that obviously the President has given voice to in various fora, including, importantly, in the Cairo speech early in the administration, where he outlined how we see democracy and human rights playing a critical role in modernization and creation of new opportunities throughout the region. As this unfolds over the course of the next several weeks, I think you'll see the U.S. government trying to take a strong role in building on the very robust programming that we have in Tunisia currently. Programming that focuses on party building, work being done by International Republican Institute, National Democratic Institute, underwritten by the National Endowment for Democracy, which really it all builds on the belief that these parties and openness contribute to increased opportunity in Tunisia and elsewhere. As it relates to Egypt, we, I think, as the Secretary said yesterday in her press conference with the Jordanian Foreign Minister, that obviously this is an important moment, that it's vitally important that the protesters and the government maintain nonviolence. But that it's also a great opportunity for the government to advance many of the things that we've talked to them, but the President outlined in the speech in Cairo, but that we've talked about them in quiet diplomatic talks and publicly as well. Things like making sure that the emergency law is lifted, things like a new elections law, things like creating the kind of space for social and democratic speech and openness. So that we can see the kind of advancement that we hope for. But again, the point here is to bring it back to our goal in this particular instance, which is nonviolence, and making sure that neither the government nor the protesters resort to the kind of actions that bespeak the goals that we all share, which is greater opportunity, greater transparency, greater democracy. And we think that's not really a threading the needle so much, Roger, as it is supporting the kinds of aspirations the President outlined in the Cairo speech and that we've, as a government, across administrations, been pushing for years.
All right. Let's turn to Ward Carroll with Military.com.
Thanks for having us here, Dennis. Obviously, a lot of the Military.com audience would be concerned about Afghanistan and the war. So let me just quickly quote the part of the speech where this president spoke to that. He said, "Thanks to our heroic troops and civilians, fewer Afghans are under control of the insurgency. There will be tough fighting ahead, and the Afghan government will need to deliver better governance. But we are strengthening the capacity of the Afghan people and building an enduring partnership with them. This year, we will work with nearly 50 countries to begin a transition to an Afghan lead. And this July, we will begin to bring our troops home." So our reader, Hugh Sims, said, "In the concerns about unemployment, we seem to have forgotten our military is still at war. We are simply wearing out men and women who constitute or continue to serve in Iraq and Afghanistan. Please tell us what constitutes victory and how we will know we have achieved our objectives." Now, I'll say the president didn't use the term victory.
Yes.
But how you know, and General Petraeus has just released a fairly sanguine yet balanced appraisal. Yeah. So from a national security point of view, what are you looking at that are good signs, you know, metrics-wise, and what are you still concerned about?
I think it's exactly the right question, Ward, and I appreciate Hugh sending it in. A couple of things. I just came from our monthly National Security Council meeting with the president on this topic. We have, for the course of the last 12 months now, had monthly updates for the president with the full chain of command from Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, although Secretary of Defense is traveling today, but the Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, all the way down to our commander, General Petraeus on the ground, and our ambassador, Ambassador Eikenberry, to also include the senior military and civilian presence in Pakistan as well. So it was a very productive conversation. It addressed many of these same questions. And it's the first, importantly, session after the annual review, which the president announced in December, which found many of the same things, interestingly, that were laid out in General Petraeus's letter. So I was struck, in fact, by the similarities between his letter and the president's statement out of the review last month. And having spent about a week on the, about 4 days on the ground myself between Christmas and New Year's, I was able to see some of that progress directly. But to this question of what defines success, the most concerning development, of course, is the number of casualties that we're seeing from our troops on the ground. We recognize, I think, as Hugh suggested in the question, the huge sacrifices that our troops have been making, not just during the course of this surge, which goes back to July 2009, coming up in July 2011 on basically 2 years of a surge presence that basically tripled the number of U.S. troops on the ground. So we recognize not just that 2 years of surge, but really you reach all the way back to 9/11, nearly 10 years now. And the op tempo for our troops and their families has been extraordinary, which is why Dr. Biden and the First Lady announced on Monday the results of our interagency, all of government approach on support to military families, everything from support to families who are current, whose a spouse is currently deployed. So what are the steps that we can take to support the families? To the steps that we can take to support schools, both military and non-military schools, or DOD and non-DOD schools. And then all the way up to the care of wounded warriors and veterans. That's a very important indication, I think, and one I hope we get a chance to talk about a little bit later. But then if you take a look at, and General Petraeus just briefed the president on this, you take a look at the reasons for the increased violence and casualties. It goes to the fact that we have, over the course of the last year, 100,000 additional Afghan National Security Forces and ISAF forces on the ground carrying out this fight. Importantly, that's as many as 70,000 additional newly trained and capable, and importantly, in the fight, Afghan National Security Forces. So we, as we take the fight to the Taliban, that's going to obviously result in greater violence and increased risk for our troops. That risk has great reward, however, and the president laid out on Tuesday night many of those rewards, including creating the space into which newly trained Afghan security forces partnered with our guys can train, become more capable so that they themselves can take on not only the Taliban, but importantly, the foreign occupiers that occupied Afghanistan for much of the 1990s, which is Al-Qaeda, Arab, Central Asian terrorists who took advantage of Afghanistan and the Afghan people. That's one. Two, also creating space for Afghan governance, and we're seeing that increasingly in a variety of institutions, all the way from Afghan local police, which is an initiative undertaken by General Petraeus, to draw on local security forces, training them, equipping them to take the fight to the Taliban, to local tribal shura, to more capable provincial and district level governors and government officials, as well as then the Kabul-based national ministry officials who, for the first time now, we're seeing resources channeled from the center all the way down to those district levels so that we can see, Afghans can see the benefit of the kind of effort that the Afghans themselves are undertaking. So how are we going to define success? One, in the most clear sense, we are going to make sure that Afghanistan does not become a base of operations or a safe haven from which Al-Qaeda can again attack the United States, our friends, or our interests. That's why we're very obviously pleased to see the progress that we're making and the Pakistanis and the Afghans are making against Al-Qaeda as a general matter. Two, we're going to make sure that Afghans have the kind of capacity to allow them to maintain the stability there so that it does not become hospitable to the likes of Al-Qaeda in the future. So again, we're seeing those indications quite clearly. We're seeing them as a result of the very positive and courageous work of our troops. And I think we're what the annual review found last week, what General Petraeus's letter of earlier this week underscores, and certainly what the briefings the President just heard, the meeting the President just heard underscores, is that we'll be in a position now come July 2011 to make a turn off this two-year-long surge. As we get now to that target of a July of 2014, end of 2014, where we transfer then the lead security role to the Afghans themselves.
So what's your sense of the magnitude of the July 2011 drawdown? Or is that all contingent on all the things you've just talked about?
Well, the drawdown itself, I think, will be contingent on, as General Petraeus has made clear and the President has made clear, on the facts on the ground. And the conditions on the ground. I think that we're seeing conditions throughout the country, and as I said, I was able to spend some time myself there and to see some of this, and I think we're seeing real pockets of opportunity and of stability, and that's a very good sign. But the slope of that drawdown, Ward, will really be determined by the results of what we see over the course of the next several months, the conditions that we see, so that we can ensure that these newly trained Afghans, and again, this number of 70,000 additional here in the last year is quite remarkable, that they're, having been partnered with our guys, having been in the fight, they're able then to take that fight and to hand off, transition these areas to Afghan governing capacity, be they kind of traditional tribal instruments or national instruments of governing power. So that exact slope will be determined. But I do think we have to also keep in mind that we're looking at now a two-year surge that tripled the number of troops that were in Afghanistan the day the President was inaugurated. So it's been a remarkable investment of resources here. So I think we'll see a change in our presence on the ground, but we're not going to, as the President said, and General Petraeus has said, we're not going to switch off the lights or run for the exits.
Okay. And to those who are participating in the chat online here on Facebook, I'm seeing a lot of great questions come in, and I'm holding some aside, but I want to give Josh Rogan here a question first.
Thank you very much. My first question comes from Facebook user Christopher Aponte. It's about the New START Treaty the President mentioned, and that the New START Treaty was successfully ratified in his State of the Union speech. Christopher would like to know, given the ratification of the New START Treaty, will the administration continue to pursue non-proliferation agreements this year, or is this treaty the end of these such formal agreements for the time being?
It's a good question. I think we're all gratified by the unanimous endorsement of the START Treaty in the upper house of the Russian Duma yesterday. That formalizes then the agreement from Russia, both houses of the Duma having ratified that treaty, so that allows an exchange of instruments of ratification, as it's called, of the treaty later this month or early next. I guess it's probably early next since we're 27th of January right now. So we think that's very important for the reasons the president outlined in the speech the other night. It just means very clearly launchers as well as warheads taken off the battlefield. What's important here is that it's not the end of our efforts. And the most specific sense, I want to be clear that we are continuing, we're making good progress against, and we're aggressively continuing the president's four-year plan to lock down all the loose fissile material in the world. We had a very successful summit last April here in Washington. I know you covered it aggressively, Josh, and we appreciated that. But even since then, and in fact, in just the last 4 to 6 weeks, the president's been quite pleased by announcements from Ukraine and even Belarus to take at-risk material and to sign agreements with Russia and others to lock that down. We think that's a great bit of progress, and we'll continue that so that we can fulfill this four-year pledge. And then, of course, we'll be working with the Russians to look at what next steps there may be in this regard. But we'll also then be working on a number of other issues. We're working on the fissile material cutoff treaty. We're working to make sure that we're working with our colleagues, both at the Board of Governors there, at the IAEA, all the way up to New York, and then at the capitals in between to make sure that we're holding the Iranians accountable. So we think that's probably the wolf closest to the door in terms of the next threat to the global proliferation regime. And we want to make sure that given the instability of that region, that the Iranians live up to their responsibilities. The president mentioned that in the speech as well. Lastly, we're very heartened by the close cooperation we've had with our allies in Seoul. We continue to be very concerned, as Secretary Gates enunciated on his last trip, both to Seoul, Beijing, and Tokyo, when he enunciated some very significant concerns about our ongoing concerns about not just North Korea's nuclear program, but also, importantly, its missile program, which Secretary Gates had public comments about last month, but I'm sure we'll have more to say about that.
Do you plan to submit the Congressional Test Ban Treaty for Senate ratification this year?
I don't know that we've made any particular plans in that regard. We'll be obviously looking for any number of opportunities now to increase our cooperation with both houses, the House and the Senate, on proliferation. We're going to need their support on a number of issues. But the right time, we'll take a look at the CTBT too, of course.
All right. And to get to a few questions from the chat online, this is probably the one that's come up the most. Martha Austin, John Stephen Lean Sr., and Mustafa El Kasabi all asked about the violence in Egypt right now and the government's actions there.
Well, it goes back to Roger's question, which is that we obviously call on the protesters and the government to not resort to violence, to obviously rely on nonviolence in this regard. But we also believe, as you've seen in public remarks from Robert Gibbs, from Secretary Clinton, from our ambassador on the ground in Cairo, and from many, many others in the administration, that we think this is also an opportunity for the government in Cairo to take the kinds of steps that we've talked about in terms of creating space, in terms of political liberalization, in terms of like very concrete steps on the election law and on the emergency law. So we're obviously following the situation quite closely. We updated the president on it this morning. He himself is obviously following it very closely. On the internet, I will say that it's one of the difficult things with this president is trying to stay ahead of him on being briefed, since he spends a lot of his own time getting himself up to speed. And I know, Jesse, you and others help in that regard. And the only problem I have with that is it makes my job harder.
can't win them all. All right, let's start another round back with Roger Michin with The Economist.
Let's move next door from Egypt over to Israel-Palestine.
Yes.
That peace process has seemed to kind of reach a stalemate, and it was notably absent any mention of Israel or Palestine from the president's speech. Is that a reflection of him putting the peace process on the back burner right now? And if not, what specific steps is the administration taking?
Well, it's not an indication of putting it in the back burner or the front burner. The fact is that this is a critical issue for the U.S. national security interests, obviously critical to our allies in Israel and critical to Palestinians and, frankly, to the region. And so we don't get to decide where to put it. It is an issue that's front and center to U.S. national security interests, and as such, we deal with it quite aggressively. In fact, Senator Mitchell has been in and out of the region here in the last week or so to continue our efforts to reach out to the parties to try to create the conditions for which, as Secretary Clinton said in her speech at Brookings early last month, for them to try to get back to resolving the core issues. We've been pretty clear in this regard that we're going to continue to aggressively push that, but we're also and we're going to try to get the parties, notwithstanding the fact that the direct talks effort of the fall has, as you suggested, Roger, taken a step back. So we're aggressively working it. We're discovering new information about each side's positions, and we're not going to be passive observers here. As the Secretary said in her speech, as Ambassador Rice has indicated, generally, as Secretary Gates has said publicly, and then, of course, as the President and the Vice President have said, we're going to be active participants here. So if we need to come up with ideas, bridging proposals or otherwise, to make sure that we're addressing the party's needs to move this process forward, we will. But I think we also recognize that we have to address these issues with urgency for the reason I said at the at the start, which is we don't get to decide where it is on the burner because this goes to the heart of the issue for many people, for the Israelis who are obviously desperate for security given the rough neighborhood they live in and the outrageous threats that they have to countenance from Iran and others on a daily basis, and for Palestinians who have great aspirations. And so we're working this. Much of what we're doing is just the difficult work of and the kind of the elbow grease of daily diplomacy. For that, the president is extraordinarily grateful for Secretary Clinton's efforts, for Senator Mitchell's efforts, and for Dennis Ross's efforts, among others, including our ambassador in Tel Aviv. But I will say just one last thing. Senator Mitchell said that he had about 750 bad days as a negotiator in Northern Ireland, and then those all came before he had one good day. So we recognize this is just going to be hard work. We recognize the intensity of feeling and the passion around these issues, and we know it's not going to be easy. The president never signed up for an easy job, so we're going to keep working it.
You said that you're constantly finding out new information about each side's positions. Can you tell us what that information is?
Well, one of the things about the daily spade work of diplomacy is you try to keep some of it quiet and you go public with some of it.
WikiLeaks is going to tell us anyway, right?
So. Let's hope not. And in any case, I think one thing that the United States does offer is the trust of both sides, and I think that that's true, irrespective of the highly damaging information that was leaked in WikiLeaks or otherwise. And so, again, we're trying to keep our eyes on the prize here. We know what the prize is, and the president's outlined that in quite clear detail, be that in Cairo or before that when he was in Israel, or be that up in New York or any place in between. We know what the prize is here. We're going to keep working with our friends to make sure we get to it.
And let's go back to military.com.
We had a number of questions about Iraq.
Yes.
So let me quickly read the president's remarks from the State of the Union regarding Iraq. So he said, look to Iraq, where nearly 100,000 of our brave men and women have left with their heads held high where American combat patrols have ended. Violence has come down and a new government has been formed. This year, our civilians will forge a lasting partnership with the Iraqi people. While we finish the job of bringing our troops out of Iraq, America's commitment has been kept. The Iraq war is coming to an end. So one of the unforeseen consequences of a war that this administration did not undertake is it shifted the balance of power with regard to Iran. So the president also said, the Iranian government now faces tougher and tighter sanctions than ever before. So from your point of view, what are your concerns with Iran and the shift in the balance of power and nuclear proliferation? I mean, what keeps you up at night about that area?
Well, look, I do think that one of the things that's quite interesting and that we've seen, we're running a strategy on Iran that's been quite explicit from day one, and we're turning the page on that and working it as we run through our strategy. And what we've, I think, had is good success in putting the Iranians back on their heels. I think that they had had a run here of believing that the balance of power in the region had in fact shifted their way for the reasons that you outlined. And they thought that be it through high oil prices or be it through relative instability in the neighborhood, that they felt that they had a pretty good. But I think if you look over the course of the last 2 years, I think any reasonable conclusion that someone would draw would suggest that the Iranians are in a far less beneficial position than they thought they were in before we started. To wit, they had an extraordinarily hotly contested internal election that called into question, frankly, by many Iranians, the fundamental tenets of much of their political system that's been in place for the last 30 years. We think that that's interesting. The second thing is that they find themselves dramatically more isolated than they have been in perhaps any time over the last decade. That includes, importantly, because of the president's close cooperation with and work, as we saw last week, with China and with Russia and Moscow. The Iranians are not finding sustenance or comfort in the places where they used to, in Beijing and Moscow. That's because of the cooperation with us, but it's also because of universal recognition of the fact that the Iranians are not living up to their obligations, be that on their human rights obligations, be that on their support for terrorism, or be that most blatantly on the nuclear program. Lastly, I think that one can't ignore the very positive developments in Baghdad. The government is now formed. I think that any fair estimation of the election and the government formation process would lead one to believe that Tehran did not get what it set out to accomplish in that regard. And that bespeaks the strength of the Iraqi people in this effort. So that's why we think it's important that the Iraqi people see, as the president outlined the other night, that we're living up to our commitments as outlined in the agreement signed by the last administration and then negotiated in the more granular details when we got here. And that we'll continue to work through our robust civilian presence in Baghdad and throughout Iraq with our Iraqi partners to ensure that they have the kind of opportunity that we know that all Iraqis desire. But the bottom line, Ward, I think, is if you line up these issues, I think that the Iranians have to feel like they're in a situation here where it's not particularly beneficial to their outlook. And they have to recognize, I think, as a result of that, that the real opportunity for them to assume their rightful place in the international community isn't through an illicit nuclear program, but rather through living up to the responsibilities that each of us as members of the international community have. Obviously, the Iranians have rights, but those rights come with responsibilities, and we'll be working, continuing to work with our partners, as we did just over the weekend after the talks in Istanbul, to ensure that they live up to those rights.
All right, let's turn to Josh Rogan with foreignpolicy.com.
Thank you. My next question comes from Gabriel Storing of Hermosa Beach, California, and he asks about Sudan. Gabriel writes, the administration invested heavy diplomatic resources towards a successful referendum in South Sudan. But as all attention was on North-South issues, the government of Sudan increased its use of violence to achieve its goals in Darfur. Darfuris feel abandoned by an administration that is loaded with people that have made strong statements and promises regarding their commitment to peace in Darfur. With conditions on the ground being the true measure of policy effectiveness, what is the administration ready to do now to bring true and lasting peace, protection, and justice to the people of Darfur?
I appreciate the question. I appreciate the fact even more that Hermosa Beach has probably got far less snow than Washington, D.C. this morning, and dramatically less than my home in Stillwater, Minnesota. But nevertheless, I will say this. I think the president feels like the Sudanese, both North and South, but Sudanese more generally have made important progress in the course of the last 8 weeks. I think that many of us, when we looked at the situation during the course of the last calendar year as we ran up to the important referendum that started on January 9, worried that that referendum would not go off. But I think it is important, as Gabriel points out, to recognize that we did invest, along with the players in the region and our partners, particularly our partners in what we call, our partners in the UK and in Norway, who have been very close partners of Scott Gratian's and Johnny Carson's and others in this effort, that each of us invested a lot in this referendum. But I think it's incorrect to suggest that somehow we focused on North-South at the expense of the ongoing crisis in Darfur. In fact, I just had a meeting in this room at this table 2 days ago with Foreign Minister Karti of the government of Sudan. And I think if one were to break down the time spent in our conversation at that meeting, I think it'd be fair to say that about 25% of the time was spent on North-South issues, including the critical issue of resolving Abyei and all the post-referendum issues now that need to be resolved by July 9, pursuant to the agreement that both North and South signed up to in the CPA. And 75% of the time then was spent on Darfur. There has been increased indications from UNAMID in both directions. There was an announcement last week out of UNAMID that expressed their appreciation for increased access and freedom of movement. We think that's very important. There is also, at the same time, however, indications that UNAMID is getting harassed in other parts of Darfur. That's a cause for concern, and we have not pulled any punches, including Ambassador Rice up in New York just yesterday, after a session in the Security Council on this matter, expressing her outrage at lack of sufficient access in Darfur. We're also aware of other very alarming reports of violence. And I will say this, that I consume an awful lot of intelligence in any day, but I've consumed a particularly large amount of intelligence on Sudan in the course of the last 6 months. We've appreciated that information, but it also suggests quite clearly that as Khartoum and Juba understand we're watching, and we're going to hold them responsible to their international obligations, as well with the Iranians, that they are deterred from taking efforts that they might have in the past, thinking that they had more freedom of action they might have taken. So we're going to continue to hold them accountable. Just over the course of the last 4 weeks or so, Josh, we've undertaken a very aggressive and private, incidentally, diplomatic campaign to make sure that both Khartoum and Juba understand that we will not tolerate any support of militant proxies in Darfur or elsewhere. This is a very stern message that we've asked others to pass on our behalf as well, but also pass directly. The bottom line is this is a moment of great opportunity for all Sudanese, North, South, Darfuris, and all Sudanese, and frankly a great opportunity for Sudanese to be a light in terms of the entire continent, if not the world, for peaceful resolution of an ongoing crisis. We think that they ought to make the most of that opportunity.
Of course, one of the incentives we offered to the government in Khartoum was that if they completed implementation of the CPA, we would consider removing them from the State Department's list of states that sponsor terror. What from now must the government in Khartoum do to keep that process of reconsideration of their status going?
Well, in the first instance, what they need to do is officially recognize the results of the referendum, and then live up to the obligations for the post-referendum issues as outlined in the CPA. The government in Khartoum has known those since 2005, frankly, after they, in a very painstaking negotiation, to the great credit that the Bush administration undertook. From the negotiation to the signing, they've known exactly what they need to do, and we'll hold them to that. Importantly, however, the statute also puts certain limitations on the Secretary of State and the President, which is that we have to make sure that the Sudanese live up to the statutory obligation, which says that we need to certify to Congress that Sudan has not supported international terrorism in the previous 6 months. So we're aggressively working that through. And frankly, we've heard positive things in the course of that review that suggests that Sudan has worked closely with us against shared terrorist concerns. But it's a high standard. The President is statutorily bound, Secretary of State statutorily bound to live up to it. And that's what we're going to do, live up to the statute outline, the standard outline of the statute. But first instance, let's finish the counting. Let's have the government in Khartoum recognize those results, and then we can start this whole process.
All right. I know Jeannie Hurtley on Facebook had a question along those same lines, so I hope that addressed it. I'll also note that the president's videographer accompanied Scott Gratian down to Sudan for a trip around the referendum, and I think we'll be publishing his video documenting that trip a little bit pretty soon in the coming days.
Importantly, that included a trip just to Darfur, and so it'll be important bit of footage. We were very pleased with a recent visit too by Nancy Lidborg, an unbelievably capable director of DACHA, assistant administrator for DACHA, it's called over at USAID. Somebody who's not only a great patriot, but an unbelievably compassionate person who, from crises all over the world, has brought great hope. But she was in Darfur recently. We're very pleased with her visit, very pleased with Scott's visit. And obviously, Iran got a lot of video on that. But also importantly, Dane Smith, an ambassador of great character and just a very highly decorated career, has also now come back as the secretary's principal senior diplomat focused on Darfur. So he'll be working that 24/7. We're going to be working that with him, and we look forward to getting this thing done.
All right, and to go ahead and take one question that came up earlier in the chat, that is something I've seen a lot of discussion on online, some good, some bad, but Gene Cuddy says, please speak to the extremely common assumption that people have about something called American exceptionalism. What are our moral/religious obligations and responsibilities to the rest of the world?
Well, I just, American exceptionalism, I think, means a lot of different things, a lot of different people. But I will say one thing that's always remarkable to me is the fact that alone, perhaps, in the United States, you have a remarkable president who was raised by his mom, educated in our public schools, and through dogged determination, his patriotism and his the great instruction that he received from teachers, as he outlined in the speech the other night, across the country, was able to become President of the United States. I think that's an extraordinarily exceptional thing. And I think it sends a very positive message to the world. As it relates to the United States' role in the world, there's no question that as a result of the actions of our people, be they our troops in Afghanistan and Iraq, in Kosovo, in Bosnia, in Kuwait, in Normandy, in North Africa, in Asia, as a result of their individual actions, as a result of their heroism, as a result of the values of this country as embodied in our Constitution. There's no doubt that people all around the world look to us with a certain amount of hope and expectation. It's a lot to live up to, there's no question about that. But the president spoke to this in the opening of the foreign policy section of the speech the other night when he said that there's no question that the United States is back. There's no question that the United States is in a leadership role in the world. And we've seen the results of that just over the course of the last 2 years. The START Treaty, as Josh pointed out, the agreement in Iraq, as Ward pointed out, the ongoing expectations of so many people throughout the world, in the Middle East or otherwise, as some of the questions have indicated. So I don't know if that's exceptionalism or just a great responsibility to live up to the standard that so many of our fathers, grandfathers, mothers, grandmothers set for us. But it is certainly what we set out to do here every day.
Okay. I think we've got less than 10 minutes left. So if you have any real quick foreign policy questions that aren't complicated at all, maybe you can take your least complicated one, and we can do a lightning round and see how it works.
I'll give you make your questions as complicated as you want. I'll make my answers short and declaratory.
Okay, this is a somewhat complicated question that I will try to uncomplicate. A number of our readers had questions that were more concerned with domestic policy than really foreign policy, but that do directly relate to foreign policy.
Yeah.
For example, energy policy, how it relates to our security interests. How our drug policy yeah. relates to our actions in Afghanistan, how immigration policy relates to our relationship with Mexico, and even stuff like our agricultural policy, our healthcare policy, how it relates to our competitiveness. When these conversations are taking place on domestic policy, is there a National Security Council person in the room? Or are these discussions taking place is there a national security aspect reflected in these discussions when the president is in the Oval Office having these conversations?
Yeah, well, a couple of things. I will say that in the first instance, we as his advisors it's incumbent on us to make sure that we're consuming all this information, to make sure that that's factoring into the recommendations and the advice that we give the president. I will say that I spend a lot of time on each of your sites. But also, as I think you pointed out when you're walking in here, Roger, I carry around your newspaper, I think you guys call it, but it looks like a magazine to me.
Thank you for that.
I don't know what you call it, Ward.
Whatever Roger tells me.
There you go. So we have to consume this information, one. Two, one of the very wise decisions General Jones made when he came in and the initial action he took in the formation of the National Security Council itself, which is the body the president chairs and then secretaries of each of the individual agencies joins for particular discussions, as, for example, the one we just had on Afghanistan. He broadened that the membership of the National Security Council to include the Department of Energy, to include, obviously, Treasury, as it has for some time, but to make sure that it is broadened out to encompass things like climate. And we can't deal with climate change without having a very firm understanding of our own energy policy. So we have a staff that draws on expertise and importantly in key areas to include economic policy and energy policy. It's intermingled under our Deputy National Security Advisor for International Economic Affairs, Mike Froman, not only reports to Tom Donilon, but also reports to Gene Sperling, at the chairman of the National Economic Council. So we are trying to structure the body itself, or the infrastructure of the White House itself, to ensure that these decisions draw on all the best thinking that's available. That's the second thing. The third thing is that the president himself often insists that if we send up a decision to him, that he sends it back to make sure that it's been coordinated across the full range of people who have a concern on these issues. Fourth, our allies and our friends make sure that we do this. I'll give you an example. Secretary Clinton was just in Mexico on Monday. I guarantee you that our conversations reflected the full range of issues, from immigration to the trafficking of weapons and money north from the north south into Mexico, as well as drugs from south to the north into the United States. So our allies themselves demand that we address these issues comprehensively. That's why it's so important for in Canada to have a Secretary of State like Secretary Clinton, who is not only an accomplished diplomat, obviously, but also somebody who understands and frankly represents so much of what's great about this country itself. So it's incumbent on us to make sure that it is intermingled in that way. Our staff is set up in such a way to allow us to do it, but it also requires a good deal of discipline. And I'll just say that the president is not afraid to instill that discipline in us to make sure that we don't cut any corners. Does that answer the question?
In the speech, the president talked about revitalizing NATO.
Yes.
Had a chance to spend some time at the airbase in Kandahar in May.
Yes.
And as you probably know, that the vibe there is a lot more international than anywhere else I went.
Yeah.
Maybe except ISAF headquarters itself.
Yeah.
So I was engaging in conversation with an Army colonel and made note of that, you know, Macedonians, Dutch, you know, all kinds of stuff. And he said, this is NATO's last mission, and if it fails or is characterized other than a success, NATO will cease to be. Do you agree in principle with that notion, and where does NATO fit in your bag of tricks?
Yeah, well, look, I say a couple things. That the facility in Kandahar is remarkable. I was just there myself. General Terry and his team are doing an unbelievable job throughout RC South, really took back Kandahar. Through a really remarkable effort right there in Kandahar City, as well as just north of it in the Argandab, and then obviously in the west in Helmand, you're seeing a kind of a civil military lash up in such a way as to really make you not only just proud of what these guys do every day, and obviously very appreciative of the sacrifice that they undertake and that great risk, but also quite hopeful for the effort that's being undertaken. As it relates to NATO, you also see this, and I had the same experience, Ward, when I was out there, which is that you go to the mess, you go to the chow hall up in Bagram, for example, and you're just as likely to be sitting down next to a Canadian guy or a Dutch guy or any number of our NATO allies, one of our allies from the UK or France or Italy. Point being that it is a very international effort, 50 countries, as the president pointed out. I think the way I look at this is that a lot of people are always looking to try to make the next fight the determinative fight. What I believe is that you have to fight every fight to make sure that and be as dogged as you can in that fight, not with any false expectation that is the determinative fight. We're not going to know which one is going to be the one that determines NATO's future, determines the opportunities for Afghans, determines the outcome definitively in Iraq. What we do know is that our dogged determination through each of those will be the thing that, at the end of the day, as with, for example, World War II, I don't think at any given time anybody knew exactly which was going to be the determinative battle. But I think that if they did suggest that they could go all in and just hope and then let their guard down at the end of that one, I think that's a false comfort and a false hope. So I think NATO has been arguably, and I think this is a pretty good argument, the most successful military alliance in history. I think that there's great momentum behind that, and great strength behind it, and I have no doubt that the effort in Afghanistan is going to be a victory and going to be successful. But I also have no doubt in the, irrespective of that, about the strength of NATO over time. I think the Lisbon summit proved that. You have NATO itself now remaking itself to take on additional new missions. Importantly in that effort, you had the Turks joining the consensus on missile defense, which we think is extraordinarily important. And incidentally, a missile defense program that now will cover all of Europe sooner against more targets is a great success of this administration. And it's exactly what the president was pointing to in that sentence in the speech.
All right.
This question comes from Facebook user Teresa Sullivan. happens to be a member of the Air Force. She writes, can you address the current situation in Lebanon concerning the investigation into the death of former Prime Minister Hariri and the ascendance of a new prime minister backed by the terrorist organization Hezbollah? How can the United States continue to arm the Lebanese armed forces if the civilian government in Lebanon is led by a Hezbollah-backed official? And how does this affect greater stability in the region?
Good question. Teresa, thanks for your service. I'll say that the question I have for you, Ward, is how she got her question in on foreignpolicy.com. But, Teresa, good question. One, I think it's very important to remember where we are in this process with this Special Tribunal for Lebanon. You had the pre-indictment sent up last Monday by the prosecutor. Remarkable development in the fact that here you have an internationally formed tribunal looking at the assassination of a former prime minister, sending up an indictment of a Hezbollah member. I think as our national security advisor Tom Donilon said about 10 days ago, maybe almost 2 weeks ago now, this is evidence, frankly, of this process stripping bare this narrative of resistance that you've heard from so many associated with Hezbollah. This tribunal is set out with a very simple yet profound mandate, which is to delegitimize the use of political assassination as an acceptable tool in this region. That indictment that was sent up 2 weeks ago now is a critically important first step in that process. And frankly, what it says about what Hezbollah is alleged to have done, or frankly did in this instance, underscores why they are reacting as aggressively as they are. The aggressiveness of their reaction bespeaks the concern they have about this outcome. Now, as it relates to the new government and the LAF, as we call them, or the Lebanese Armed Forces, we think that it's a very important independent institution. We think that what's remarkable about Lebanon is here you have a multi-ethnic, multi-religious democracy in the heart of a very difficult region. Unfortunately, you have too often forces like Hezbollah reaching toward illegitimate tools like intimidation and violence to try to advance their interests in that regard. We want to get away from that. We want to get to an instance. This is why things like the STL and the Special Tribunal for Lebanon and the Lebanese Armed Forces are so important. That's why we support the Lebanese Armed Forces, not because of an association or non-association with Hezbollah, but rather because of their independence. Their independence from any political actor. Their independence to be an independent institution, democratic institution, in the heart of this very important experiment in the Middle East. We think that's important. We're going to continue to work with them, but obviously we're going to take a hard look at each of the developments along the way. I noticed a very strong and good statement out of our ambassador in Beirut today. She had a very important meeting with the new the prime minister designate. We think that's her statement. We obviously from here associate ourselves very strongly with her remarks, and obviously underscore the importance of her work and the work of her team over the course of these last several months. We started hearing the threats from Hezbollah some 6 or 7 months ago about the STL and the grave threat it poses. We understand now why they were so worried about it, because it does point up their tactics and the fact that they should not be considered legitimate by anybody. That said, it's been through the good work of Ambassador Maura Connelly, Jeff Feltman, Dan Shapiro, many others that we've been able to get to the situation, get to the point where we are now.
You got time for one more from online here?
I'm ready for it.
All right. So one thing that's come up a bunch of times has been China. Ju Chen asked, how will U.S.-China policy or the nature of the bilateral relationship change in the coming years? Cynthia Yildrum suggests we need to become a better friend to South American countries than China is. And Daryl Bielier, it looks like to me, says, does our indebtedness to China affect our foreign policy with them? So whatever you can cover in 25 minutes or so.
All right, that's good. I have about 30 minutes, is that right?
Yeah.
Look, I think that you heard, importantly on the South America question, you heard big piece of news in the speech the other night was the announcement that the president will go to Brazil, Chile, and El Salvador later this year, this spring, I think he said. We think that's important. It's another opportunity to deepen our ties, partnership with the region. That's one. Two, as it relates to China, I think that we saw this play out very well in the press conference that the president had, which is probably the most public aspect of the state visit last week, I guess, or 2 weeks ago, losing track of time. Which is that we see, and I think you heard the president say in his remarks, that we're trying to work through a competitive cooperation here with China. We recognize, not that we're threatened specifically by a strong China, but we want to make sure that China becomes a responsible competitor in the context of U.S.-China relations. Obviously, that comes with, as we were talking earlier, that those rights come with great responsibilities. Those responsibilities include, importantly, on economic affairs, means obviously living up to international agreements as it relates to currency, as it relates to intellectual property rights, as it relates to, importantly, human rights, the right to be heard, the right to free assembly, and the right to, importantly, an issue of great importance to the president, to freedom of religion. So we're going to continue to push on those, even as we cooperate with China on very important issues. We have had great cooperation, as has been outlined in stories since last week, on issues like Iran, on issues like increasingly North Korea. And so we'll see exactly how this plays out over time. But we think that China, given its size, given its location, is going to be obviously a key member of the international community. We'll continue to work with China where we can, and we'll continue to challenge China where we must. And that's going to continue to be on issues like human rights, as you heard quite explicitly last week from the president. Lastly, as it relates to indebtedness, this is something that the president addressed very clearly in the speech the other night, which is that given the depth of the economic crisis that we were presented with, that we inherited when we came to office, we had to make a series of choices to stave off to keep the deepest recession from the Great Depression from turning into another Great Depression. That was an emergency effort that had to be undertaken. Now, as this recovery begins to get steam, we also have to make very difficult choices about where we invest the critical resources of the American taxpayer. The president laid out exactly how he'll do it the other night. He obviously looks forward to working with a new Congress and the House and the Senate to do that. And we'll just keep working through these issues. But obviously, we have to see them, as Roger suggested, not only how do our domestic priorities and policies impact our national security priorities, but also how do our national security policies and priorities impact our efforts here at home. This is why we want to make sure what we're doing in Iraq is sustainable over the long haul, that the goals in Afghanistan are very clear, articulatable, and accomplishable in a way that's sustainable over time. And I think our troops are demonstrating that that's in fact the case as we lay this out. And I think that was laid out quite well in General Petraeus's letter the other night as it relates to Afghanistan. So bottom line is, China encapsulates a lot of the very most difficult issues we're wrestling with every day, but we feel like we're making some good progress on them.
All right. Well, I'll let everybody wrap up here. I want to thank The Economist, Military.com, ForeignPolicy.com for all being represented here. I want to thank everybody for joining the discussion. Sorry we couldn't get to more of the questions, but I think we covered a fair amount of ground there. And as always, thank you, Dennis. And also for people at home, you'll find the Education Roundtable at 3:15 and the Healthcare Reform Roundtable at 4:30. So come back for that too. And thanks again to everybody here.
Thanks, Roger, Ward, Josh. Really appreciate you guys coming in. Appreciate everybody online. Appreciate it.